This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. On the third night of the Republican National Convention, Vice President Mike Pence accepted the party's nomination for a second term. Republicans opened up the night with an aggressive defense of law enforcement. That message comes as the nation faces renewed tensions following the police shooting of a black man in Wisconsin that sparked three nights of protest in a state that could decide the fall election. U.S. President Trump officially accepts the party's nomination Thursday night. Democrats formally nominated former Vice President Joe Biden and U.S. Senator Kamala Harris last week. A white 17-year-old police admirer has been arrested after the killing of the two people during the third night of protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin, over the police shooting of a black man, Jacob Blake. Kyle Rittenhouse of Illinois was taken into custody Wednesday in Illinois on suspicion of first-degree intentional homicide. It's in Antioch, which is about 15 miles from Kenosha. Two people were killed Tuesday night in an attack carried out by a young white man who was caught on cell phone video opening fire in the middle of the street with a semi-automatic rifle. The U.S. State Department, or I should say Department of Justice, says the officer who shot Blake is a 7-year veteran of the Kenosha Police Department. While all of this is happening, forecasters are keeping an eye on Hurricane Laura, which has strengthened into a menacing Category 4 storm. Its power is raising fears of a 20-foot storm surge that forecasters say would be unsurvivable and capable of sinking entire communities on the Texas and Louisiana coast. Authorities implored coastal residents to evacuate, but not everyone did. The storm grew nearly 87% in power in just 24 hours to reach a Category 3 status, and it continued to draw energy from the warm Gulf of Mexico waters. This is VOA News. The white supremacist who slaughtered 51 worshippers at two New Zealand mosques has been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge imposed the maximum available sentence on Britton Harrison Tarrant, the first time the sentence has been imposed in New Zealand. The March 2019 attacks targeting people praying at two mosques shocked New Zealand and prompted new laws banning some semi-automatic weapons. They also prompted global changes to social media protocols after the gunman live streamed his attack on Facebook, where it was viewed by hundreds of thousands of people. U.S. health officials have changed their COVID-19 testing advice regarding those who are in close contact with those who are infected. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has details.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had been advising tests for people who've been within 6 feet of an infected person for more than 15 minutes. But in new guidance on its website, the CDC says that's no longer recommended for people not showing symptoms. The change stunned health experts, who note the CDC itself has said as many as 40% of those infected do not show symptoms, and testing contacts of those infected is vital to containing outbreaks.
The CDC guidelines that they have put forth are scary and dangerous.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi accuses the Trump administration of forcing the change because President Trump wants to see positive test numbers drop. Sagar Magani, Washington.
More than 824,000 people have died globally from COVID-19. More than a third are in the U.S. and Brazil combined. The number of infections hit another milestone of 24 million and counting, with the bulk of those infections in the U.S., Brazil, and India. Russia has the fourth highest and is almost at 1 million cases. South Korea reported 441 new coronavirus cases as of Wednesday. It's the most daily infections since early March, when the country had the first large outbreak. All three NBA playoff games scheduled for Wednesday have been postponed, with players around the league choosing to boycott in their strongest statement yet against racial injustice. Called off were games between Milwaukee in Orlando, Houston in Oklahoma City, and Los Angeles Lakers in Portland. The NBA said all the three games would be rescheduled, yet it did not say exactly when. And the 10th-ranked woman tennis player in the world, Naomi Osaka, said she has pulled out of the semifinals of a tennis tournament in protest of racial injustice. Osaka has a Japanese mother and a Haitian father. She said in a social media post, "Before I am an athlete, I am a black woman." Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatiany in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's president has declined in new COVID-19 cases, but extends the curfew.
The nationwide curfew that is currently in force between the hours of 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. daily and is hereby extended by a further 30 days.
Kenya's health ministry says women and children's nutrition has improved. Uganda presidential candidate Bobby Wine reacts to being sued over his political party. Malawi's State House will introduce weekly television press briefings in September. And the first group of Burundi refugees in Rwanda will voluntarily be repatriated today, Thursday.
These people will go back with a reintegration package provided by UNHCR, so there is cash assistance, $70 per adult and $35 per children. They will get also assistance for transport to their villages of origin.
And a new study says West Africa teachers are paid less than other professionals. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uhuru Kenyatta says his country is on a winning path against the COVID-19 pandemic. Speaking Wednesday during his State of the Nation address, Mr. Kenyatta said the infection rate dropped significantly from a high of 13% to 8% in August. However, the president extended the curfew by 30 days. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, President Kenyatta has also ordered the country's investigative agencies to speed up their investigations into the alleged misuse of COVID-19 funds at the Ministry of Health.
President Uhuru Kenyatta has finally bowed to pressure from the public demanding investigation into the misappropriation of COVID-19 funds at the Ministry of Health. Kenya's Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission, investigating the loss of more than 7 billion Kenya shillings for COVID-19 funds in contracts issued by the Kenya Medical Supplies Authority, KEMSA, whose chief executive officer, Jonah Manjari, and three other senior officials were suspended pending investigations. And yesterday, Wednesday, in his State of the Nation address, President Kenyatta directed the country's investigative agencies to accelerate investigations into the use of COVID-19 funds and finalize in 3 weeks' time.
The relevant agencies should expedite their ongoing investigations and conclude the same within 21 days from the date hereof. That all persons found to be prima facie culpable as a result of those ongoing investigations should be brought to book, notwithstanding their public office or their political and, for that matter, their social status.
Mr. Kenyatta noted with concern the wave of infection that is now moving from the original hotspots of Mombasa and Nairobi to rural areas in the counties. He also directed Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i to work in conjunction with the Council of Governors Chairperson Weekly for Paranya in organizing a national consultative conference to review the progress made so far in COVID-19 response in counties.
We chart Kenya's post-COVID future because this is a future that we can see if we continue with our civic responsibility. This crisis has, however, begun to percolate to the counties. The new frontier of this invisible enemy is increasingly shifting to the counties and to our rural areas.
However, the dusk to dawn curfew will remain in force for 30 more days, as restriction of people attending public events, one of the measures that was put in place to curb the spread of COVID-19, has been reviewed upwards as the COVID-19 infections reduce in the country.
In accordance with the recommendations of the Interfaith Council, the maximum numbers of persons permitted to attend funerals and weddings is reviewed upwards from 15 to 100, with all in attendance abiding the Ministry of Health protocol. That the nationwide curfew that is currently in force between the hours of 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. daily be and is hereby extended by a further 30 days.
According to the Ministry of Health, since Tuesday, 213 people have tested positive for the virus, raising the country's caseload to 33,016 people. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Somalia's Ministry of Health and the UN Children's Fund in a joint report say women and child nutrition has improved in the country during the past decade. But for millions of Somali children under age 5, good nutrition is still out of reach. As Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, the COVID-19 pandemic has only worsened the situation.
For the first time in decades, the Somali government has been able to conduct a survey across the country looking at the nutritional level of children under the age of 5. The survey, conducted between December 2018 and July 2019, shows higher vitamin and mineral levels in children and thus credited to improved food security and a higher status for women in the country over the past decade. Melanie Galvin, the Chief of Nutrition at the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, discusses the situation.
There's certainly nutrition programs scaled up over the past decade as well that provide vitamins and minerals, provide access to counseling for breastfeeding. So there's some things that certainly we would see nutrition-wise. There are non-nutritional items that, non-nutritional aspects that we can see that will improve the nutritional status of a population, like more education for women, economic development, better employment opportunities, people marrying at a later age.
The survey, conducted jointly by the Ministry of Health and UNICEF, collected blood and urine samples of 2,172 people, with 1,961 of the children below the age of 5, to check vitamin and mineral levels in their bodies. According to the survey, the nutrition status of women and children has improved since 2009. 9 in 10 infants are breastfed, and the prevalence of both stunting and wasting has decreased. Galvin says while many Somali babies are breastfed, only a third of them are exclusively breastfed for 6 months.
We've seen that exclusive breastfeeding seems to be going backwards, and that is something that we really will take a very detailed look at. Because it's something, breastfeeding is well practiced in Somalia. It is most women seem to breastfeed, and we just have to teach them that exclusive breastfeeding is the way to go. So it's a matter of modifying their current behavior.
Osama Abdi is a doctor at the Kalkal Hospital in Mogadishu. He says more parents now are open to improving their children's health by seeking health services, which is a marked improvement from the past, where many stayed at home without help.
We can remarkably see some change. If you see when a mother comes to the clinic with her child malnourished, you treat that child, she comes with the next child, she comes herself, she calls the family and the rest of the family. That already has changed the community narrative of not going to the services or just staying at home. We can notice the change related to the nutritional status, but these changes cannot be noticed so early.
The researchers are calling for intervention to improve women's nutrition before and during pregnancy and to encourage breastfeeding for the first hour of life. They're also urging the interventions to improve infant and young child feeding practices and to improve vitamin and mineral intakes. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
The first group of the estimated 60,000 Burundi refugees in Rwanda will be repatriated today, Thursday, from the Mahama refugee camp. Rwanda's Ministry of Emergency Management reportedly said the first group will number between 500 and 600. The repatriation comes as the two countries are taking steps to restore their rocky relations. Military intelligence chiefs of both countries met yesterday, Wednesday, at a border post. Elise Chaland is the External Relations Officer for UNHCR Rwanda. She says some of the refugees petitioned to return home following Burundi's peaceful election. Ville Chaland said UNHCR is facilitating the voluntary repatriation with resettlement cash assistance.
As you know, there was a presidential election in Burundi this year, and the election process went peacefully. So a few months after the election took place, some of the refugees in the Mahama camp, which is one of the biggest camps in Rwanda with Burundian refugees, some of the refugees wrote a petition letter to the Burundian authorities requesting to be assisted to return back to their home country. This letter was sent on the 26th of July. It was a new element for us because before refugees were always stating that they would wait to see a change in their country. But apparently with the new development, some of them were expressing the will to go back.
So, Elise, did the UNHCR have any role to play in this repatriation?
As UNHCR, it's also in our mandate to support the implementation of durable solutions for refugee situations. So what we did is that we advocated and facilitated a technical conversation between both governments and UNHCR to discuss about the voluntary repatriation process of Burundian refugees to their home country. This meeting took place on the 13th of August. Following this meeting, we first agreed on the repatriation process, the various steps and responsibilities in the repatriation process. But we also agreed on the date of the 27th of August for the organization of the first repatriation convoy. In the last 2 weeks, UNHCR has been working with refugees and refugee leaders in the camp to register the intentions of returns of the refugees who would like to take that chance to go back home. We have to insist that it's an individual and voluntary decision. It means that refugees make the decision for themselves, and those who are not ready to come back yet see their international protection maintained in Rwanda, so they can still enjoy the refugee status.
I'm sure the UNHCR is aware that some of these people fled Burundi because of different reasons. So do you know what kind of life they are going to be returning to?
The people living in Mahama camp come mainly from the Kirundo region, which is just across the border between Rwanda and Burundi. They mainly have a farming background. These people will go back with a reintegration package provided by UNHCR. So there is cash assistance, $70 per adult and $35 per children. It's the same package that is offered to any Burundian refugees coming back to their country of origin. They will get also assistance for transport to their villages of origin, areas of return. And once they are there, this is when the reintegration starts. It means that there will be reintegration programs supporting their livelihood. And since we know that they are mostly farmers, probably that they will resume the activities that they had before with the support of UNHCR, the authorities, but also of partners who might be supporting this reintegration and livelihoods program.
Elise, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us. I do appreciate very much.
You are most welcome, and thank you for your interest in the cause of refugees and returnees.
Elise Ville-Chalon is the External Relations Officer for UNHCR Rwanda. She was speaking with us from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 27. In Uganda, the party of presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, widely known as Bobi Wine, is playing down reports that Mr. Wine has been sued over the registration and ownership of his recently formed National Unity Party Platform Party. Two people claiming to be founding members of the party petitioned the High Court, saying that Wine illegally acquired ownership of the party. They want the court to order the Elections Commission to degazette the change of the party's name. Party spokesperson Joe Senyanyi says the individuals are on shaky grounds as they are not even members of the party.
We have heard about the lawsuit. We have not been served yet, but it's been out there in the media. However, of course, this is not surprising. You know, whoever, you know, decides to challenge President Museveni's leadership gets to be met by all these frivolous and trumped up lawsuits and charges. You know, when Dr. Kizza Besigye was challenging President Museveni at the time, they trumped up rape charges and all manner of things. So with us too, we know that they will throw all of these different things at us. What's interesting, though, is that all the people that are suing are actually not members of the party as they purport to be. They are not in the party register. They don't hold membership cards of the party. So this is going to be an easy case for us to sail through, because the very first, you know, question which I'll pose in court is, are you people members like you claim? If you say you members, prove your membership, and they will have no way to prove.
The allegation is that the Honorable Bobi Wine manipulated the party to make himself the flag bearer of the presidential candidate of the party. Did he manipulate? What do you think they are talking about?
So a delegates conference was held and notice was put out. Actually, the notice was put out in the government newspaper just so that nobody pretends they didn't get to see it. It was in the government newspaper. And all those who were meant to attend the delegates conference did attend the delegates conference. So the people who are claiming, you know, who say they were supposed to be at the delegates conference, but they were not invited, they're not party members. They're not in the party register. They don't hold membership cards. So there was no way they were going to be invited for the party's delegates conference. They're non-entities, okay, as far as we are concerned and as far as the law is concerned. So we know for a fact that they are chasing after the wind.
Now, the petitioners are asking the court to get the Electoral Commission to de-gazette the name of the party. Is it likely?
None of that is, because every process that happened, change of name, change of leadership, everything happened within the law. And that is why the Electoral Commission, which is the superintendent of political parties, did stamp and approve every change that happened, because it happened within the law. I mean, we know for a fact that the state is targeting us, so we would be the last people not to follow the law in whatever we are doing, because they scrutinize us and look out for every little thing. So we had to make sure we cross every T and dot every I as far as the law is concerned. So we did that.
As you know, this is the political season. Is there a possibility that the group that is suing the party of Mr. Bobi Wine, that they may have some other leanings?
It's possible they have been planted by the state. Like I've told you, you know, the state is notorious for doing these things. In Arua, when Bobi Wine was tortured, they got guns and rounds of ammunition and planted them in his hotel room and faked up charges that, you know, he had these guns and they belonged to him and so on, until the truth was found out that they actually did not belong to him. They were just planted there. So it's not new that the state will do such a thing. But the law, as far as we're concerned on our end, the law has followed to the letter. So we're good to go.
Joe Sanyonyi, a spokesperson for Uganda presidential candidate Bobi Wine's National Unity Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. The spokesperson for Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera says the president is contemplating introducing weekly television press briefings similar to the U.S. White House. Brian Banda says the briefings will start September 7th and would be handled by the president's press team and the Minister of Information. He also says President Chakwera is interested in opening State House to the people for sightseeing and photo opportunities. But Banda says the main purpose of the weekly press briefings would be to dispel fake news.
The biggest challenge that we are facing today in government is the creation and the spreading of fake news. So these State House press briefings, which will commence on the 7th of September, will give an opportunity for the media to come to the State House and get briefed on what the president is doing that particular week, but also give an overview of what the president has been doing the week just ending. So it's a win-win situation for us as State House and for the media, because they'll get to know what the president is doing, but also it's an opportunity to confirm or to ask questions in as far as the presidency is concerned.
When does it begin, and should Malawians expect that President Chakwera himself will appear at the briefings?
The briefings will start on Monday, the 7th of September, and they will be live on television and radio from 11 o'clock Central African time. They will be done by myself as the presidential press secretary and my colleague, Sean Kampondeni, who is the director of communications at the State House. We are hoping that once in a while, the president will pop in and say hello to journalists during the briefing and even take a few questions. But these are solely done by the Department of Communication at State House.
Is it true, Brian, that the president, that he plans to launch something like we have here in the United States, a White House annual correspondent dinner? Is that true?
Those arrangements are in the pipeline. I cannot comment fully now. A number of things, but we are doing them stage by stage. Those are ideas in the pipeline, but what I can confidently say at this hour is that we are ready and geared for the State House press briefings.
This article is saying that President Chakwera would like to turn his residence or the president's house where people can come and visit. Is that true?
As I said, those are ideas that we are working on. I want to agree with you. A president is voted by the people. And the people should have access to see where he lives. But as I said, I cannot independently comment on these things right now. But we are working to demystify the State House.
Brian, we do appreciate very much. It's nice talking with you, and thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure, sir.
Brian Banda is the spokesperson for Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera. You are speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. According to a new study conducted by the Center for Global Development, teachers in West Africa are paid much less than other professionals with comparable levels of education and experience. One of the study's authors, Dave Evans, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the research.
In Western Africa, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, teachers make about 10% less than other workers. In Liberia, teachers make more than 40% less than other workers per month. And in Sierra Leone, they make more than 40% less than other workers per month. So this is a striking finding that holds up in a number of countries in the region. But at the same time, what we find is that in every country in our sample, teachers report working fewer hours than other workers. And this isn't just an official statistic of how much teachers work. We all know that teachers work more than often than their official statistic. But these numbers come from personal reports that the teachers give about how many hours they work. And so even based on that, they're working fewer hours than these other workers.
You guys also looked into contract versus salary. I mean, I think, did you guys find that teachers were telling you that their pay and their work conditions affected their ability to educate?
The takeaway from that earlier point is that if you look at the hourly wages of teachers, the hourly earnings of teachers tend to be higher in many of the countries in our sample. So in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, even though teachers make less per month, because they work fewer hours, they actually make more per hour. The same is true in Sierra Leone. Now, it's not true in every country. So there's a lot of variation across countries, even in West Africa. To your question about, you know, how this affects the ability of teachers to do their job, one of the things that we see is that teachers are much more likely than other workers to take a second job. And so they're about 50% more likely. Other workers, about 12% of them have a second job. A lot of teachers are taking a second job in order to make ends meet. And obviously that can have an impact on their performance.
Did your study find out why this teacher pay is so low? And if there are any movements within any of these countries to increase it?
So we looked at what explains why teachers get paid less or paid more, depending on the country, than other workers. And we tried to see, well, is it related to the level of poverty in the country? Is it related to the number of women who are working? Is it related to the union, the power of the union? And strikingly, if we look across the countries, none of these factors explain why teachers make less or more than other workers, including the level of unionization. But we do see countries taking action. And so just in the last couple of years, we've seen teacher strikes in Angola and Mali and Uganda and Kenya and Senegal and elsewhere. And teacher pay is usually not the only request, but is usually one of the demands among the demands that teachers have for improving the quality of their work environment. And so teachers are taking action.
That was Dave Evans, a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. And that's it for this Thursday, August 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa, I'm James Butt in Washington saying, have a great day.
What is widely seen as a fraudulent election in Belarus, a broad cross-section of its citizens has taken to the streets to protest the regime of Alexander Lukashenko. On the next edition of Encounter, two Eurasian experts talk with Carol Castiel about the possibility of democratic change in this long-standing authoritarian regime. Encounter. Listen for it this Saturday and Sunday on VOA. Coming up next on VOA's press conference USA. K. Carol Castiel talks with John Fortier and Jim Kessler, two experts on U.S. politics, about the substance and style in the recently concluded Republican and Democratic National Party conventions. Press Conference USA. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.